Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. A coalition of six nations, the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Britain, call for an immediate ceasefire in Aleppo. They are condemning Russia for interfering with attempts to bring humanitarian aid to civilians trapped in the Syrian city. They are also calling on the Syrian government to agree to a United Nations plan to send humanitarian aid into the city. Meanwhile, Syrian forces advanced further into Aleppo, forcing more people into a shrinking rebel enclave. NATO's chief has urged allies to maintain sanctions against Russia. He spoke as foreign ministers wrapped up a two-day meeting in Brussels. Lisa Bryant reports.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said ceasefire violations have increased massively in eastern Ukraine, with hundreds of explosions daily from military equipment banned under the Minsk ceasefire accord.
The international community must keep pressuring Russia to respect its obligations.
He said a four-way meeting last week between Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany did not make headway in shoring up the Minsk agreement. But he said diplomacy is the only solution. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
A Pakistani plane crashed while traveling from the northern town of Chitral to Islamabad Wednesday. All 48 people aboard the plane were killed. The Pakistan International Airlines plane went down and burst into flames in an isolated mountainous region near the town of Havelian. 42 passengers, 5 crew members, and a ground engineer were aboard. The airline's chairman told reporters the pilot had informed the control tower that one of the plane's engines had stopped functioning. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen retired Marine General John Kelly to lead the Department of Homeland Security. That agency is tasked with combating terrorism. Trump also says former critic Mitt Romney is still being considered for Secretary of State. Time magazine named President-elect Trump as its annual Person of the Year Wednesday. Brian Walsh is Time's foreign editor.
What we're saying here, essentially, this is someone who was influential, you know, and we note very much in the story, we note on the cover, actually, we call him the President of the Divided States of America, that his success electorally did not necessarily mean that he wasn't doing bad things, I think, to the country in that campaign.
Other reported appointments, Trump has selected Iowa Governor Terry Branstad as the next U.S. ambassador to China. The Associated Press says a source close to Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt says he will be nominated to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. The military coalition fighting to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul made an unusual strike Wednesday on militants holed up in a hospital building. The coalition says the building had been taken over by militants who were firing guns and rockets at Iraqi forces. It's unclear how many casualties. Authorities in Indonesia Wednesday declared a two-week state of emergency after an earthquake hit Aceh province. That quake on the northern tip of Sumatra Island killed at least 97 people. More than 500 have been injured. Arab Gulf countries wrapped up a two-day summit in Bahrain's capital Wednesday. Edward Iranian has the report.
King Hamad of Bahrain sounded a cheerful note in his final remarks to the 37th annual summit in Manama of the Gulf Cooperation Council. The king thanked his fellow Gulf leaders for attending, along with British Prime Minister Theresa May for her presence. Prime Minister May vowed to strengthen defense cooperation with the Gulf states, noting that Britain would help them defend against what she called Iran's aggressive regional actions. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
The British Parliament voted Wednesday to support Prime Minister Theresa May's March 31st deadline to begin the nation's formal exit from the European Union. The government agreed to reveal some details about its negotiations on Brexit. Ms. May had been reluctant to reveal much, believing that doing so would weaken Britain's hand in the talks. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected a meeting in France with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. The proposed December meeting in Paris was aimed at restarting stalled Middle East peace efforts. Mr. Netanyahu expressed willingness to meet privately with Abbas, but not at international conferences such as the French-sponsored summit. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Votes are being counted in Wednesday's Ghana presidential and parliamentary elections.
The supporters of the main opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, are in an expectant mood because early results shown so far appear to be favoring Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo, but it's too early to determine that in full.
That's VOA's Peter Clotte in Accra, Ghana. Correspondent Francesca Kekra-Forson will explain how the voting process went on Wednesday. Kenyan security forces are accused of committing extrajudicial killings. The Committee to Protect Journalists condemns South Sudan's government for expelling an Associated Press reporter, but the government defends its action.
We have the right to deport any journalist who does not conform with our laws, who is in flagrant violation of our laws. We have the right to deport him. This is the right in all the countries.
Michael Makuei, South Sudan's Minister of Information, a top African Union official, is calling on South Sudan's government to apprehend and punish soldiers who sexually abuse women. Outgoing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will reflect on a decade at the helm of the United Nations and will introduce you to a man from Mali who makes prosthetic legs. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Votes are being counted in Wednesday's Ghana presidential and parlementary election. President John Dramani Mahama is seeking a full term after taking over from John Atta Mills, who died in 2012. He's being challenged by three other candidates, including Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party. On the line from Accra is VOA's Peter Clotte, who is covering the Ghanaian election. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, James. How are you?
Thank you very much. We're doing great here in Washington. Tell us, please, how is the vote counting going?
Well, the vote counting has been going on quite well since polls closed officially at 5 p.m. last night. It was smooth. It's been peaceful. People are protecting their vote, and the results are trickling in, the results of the parliamentary election and the presidential election. For the parliamentary election, the results are declared at the various constituency levels where these parliamentarians will represent. However, for the presidential election, it's only the chairperson of the Electoral Commission who is mandated by the Constitution to declare who won the election. And so far, the results are trickling in, and the New Patriotic Party supporters are looking good and happy for now.
You mean the challenger?
Yes, main opposition leader Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo.
So what's the mood in the country as they await the results?
The mood is that of high expectations on both sides, because this presidential election was competitively run by both parties. Both parties had mammoth rallies during in the last few days. The ruling party had it at the Accra Sports Stadium, where they said over 80,000 people attended. The New Patriotic Party, the main opposition party, also held this at the trade fair site, where over 60,000 people were said to have attended the rally. So it's that of high expectations, and people are not sleeping. People stayed up all night and at the various coalition centers listening as the votes come in, and as the tally comes in, and as various news organizations churn out certified results of the election.
Peter, we must make clear, these are just preliminary results.
Preliminary results, but actually the Electoral Commission Act is coming out with certified results now.
Okay, so, listening to you, following the, the stunning defeat of Gambia's longtime president, Yahya Jammeh, Africa is watching to see whether this is the year of the outsider or the challengers, or whether, for example, Ghana's President John Mahama, the incumbent, will be reelected.
Well, it remains to be seen if that will be done here in Ghana. However, the supporters of the main opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, are in an expectant mood because early results shown so far appear to be favoring Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo, but it's too early to determine that in full. So we are waiting and seeing what the results will be and what the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, Madame Charlotte Osei, would say when the results are finally compiled for the presidential election to announce the outcome of the presidential vote and declare the winner.
I listened to your interview earlier this week with main opposition candidate Nana Akufo-Addo talking about how, if he's elected, he will fix the economy. It seems to me that no matter who is elected, whether President Mahama is re-elected or he's replaced by Akufo-Addo, the Ghanaian economy is expected to be a challenge.
Yes, it is expected to be a challenge because both parties in their manifestos promised to boost the economy, to create jobs for the youth, to ensure that people have monies in their pocket. One of the accusations the NPP has leveled against the ruling party, and for that matter, President John Dramani Mahama, is that he has not been able to manage the country's economy effectively, and that measures his government has implemented appears not to have worked effectively. And charges of corruption have also been leveled against the ruling party, although the ruling party denies that it is just a perception and that there is nothing wrong that they are doing to pad their pockets, supposedly as alleged by the New Patriotic Party. But it remains to be seen who the voters are choosing at the moment. At the moment, as some of these results come in, it's too early to determine who will win. But I think by tomorrow, we should have a clear or somewhat of a better understanding of who is in the lead.
Thank you very much, Peter, for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
You're welcome, James.
That's VOA's Peter Clotte in Ghana's capital, Accra, where he's covering that country's presidential and parliamentary elections. Francesca Kekra-Forson reports from Accra that, for the most part, voting went smoothly on Wednesday.
Voting in the capital, Accra, proceeded peacefully but slowly as people waited in long lines for their turn to vote. Some people spent the night at their respective polling stations in order to cast their ballot early. A voter in the Ayawaso constituency, Evans Boachi, took the opposite approach.
I'm here to exercise my franchise to vote.
Okay, what time did you get here and how long have you been waiting?
Oh, okay, I got here like 5 minutes ago. I just decided to come in the afternoon because I know the queue would have gone down.
Charles Ayambere was happy to have successfully voted.
Yeah, I've voted.
Okay, tell me how it went.
Oh, it went well. At the morning, it was busy, but as of now, the queue is going slowly, but it's going on. I came here, that was 8 o'clock.
Asked who he voted for, Ayambere said, "Oh, that's my secret." But not everyone was happy. This woman was prevented from voting because her name was not in the register.
I'm having a problem right now, so I haven't sorted it out right now.
Yeah, I cannot find my name.
Do you know why?
Yeah, the card I have is the same card I voted with.
But they said this is the old one, so I want to verify with them.
So what are you going to do?
They say maybe it could be a spelling mistake, so I'm trying to check with them.
President Mahama, candidate for the ruling NDC party, voted in his hometown of Bole in the north and told Ghanaians he had done his best. His rival, Nana Akufo-Addo, leader of the main opposition NPP, cast his ballot in his hometown of Chebbi in the east. Although voting started late in some places due to the late arrival of voting materials, the Electoral Commission says the exercise has been smooth. Local and international observer groups, as well as the U.S. ambassador to Ghana, Robert Jackson, have commended the election process so far. This is the seventh time Ghana has held national elections since becoming a constitutional multi-party democracy in 1992. The nation of 27 million has witnessed several peaceful transfers of power and is considered one of the most stable countries in Africa. Francisca Kakra-Forson, VOA News, Accra.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 8th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The government of South Sudan is defending its decision to expel an Associated Press reporter from the country. The Associated Press announced on Tuesday this week that reporter Justin Lynch was arrested and later deported from the country by government agents because of his reporting on South Sudan. Minister of Information Michael McQuay says he's not aware whether reporter Lynch was deported, but McQuay says the government has the right to deport any journalist who does not conform with South Sudan laws.
We have the right to deport any journalist who does not conform with our laws, who is in flagrant violation of our laws. We have the right to deport him. This is the right in all the countries. South Sudan is not a new... By the way, South Sudan is a new state, but South Sudanese are not new. We know what happens in the world. We are not the only country that has deported a journalist now. Not journalists. Any non-South Sudanese can be deported if he or she is found to be in conflict with the law. So it is not a matter of being a journalist. Any citizen, any non-citizen can be deported.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan Minister of Information. The Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ, is calling on South Sudan's government to immediately reverse its expulsion of Associated Press reporter Justin Lynch. Lynch was arrested Tuesday this week and put on a plane to Uganda. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, says he is not aware whether reporter Lynch was deported, but McQuay says the government has the right to deport any journalist who does not conform with South Sudan laws. Muriti Mutiga, CPJ's East Africa representative, says the South Sudan government should stop interfering with journalists' ability to work freely. He says Lynch's expulsion is yet another example of much of President Salva Kiir's government fears independent media coverage.
We are certainly very, very concerned about the expulsion of the Associated Press reporter from South Sudan. Basically, there's no way in which an independent reporter, an independent journalist should be viewed as an enemy of South Sudan. It is absolutely unacceptable that Justin Lynch was expelled from South Sudan simply for doing his job.
Have you been able to get any information from the South Sudan government as to the reasons for Mr. Lynch's expulsion?
We have certainly requested that, and we have spoken to them, but we have not received any response, unfortunately, so far.
But have you been able to speak to Mr. Lynch himself?
Yes. You know, the thing is, we got the number for Mr. Lynch, and he came back to Nairobi, but he has not been reachable on phone yet. Obviously, he needs to recover and, settle back into the rhythms of life here. So we have unfortunately not been able to speak to him yet.
You say that the expulsion of Justin Lynch is yet another illustration of how much President Salva Kiir's government fears independent media coverage. What exactly are you saying?
What we are saying is this. Essentially, that no government which is completely legitimate and able to withstand scrutiny from all quarters would want to arbitrarily jail and arrest and basically completely muzzle independent voices from simply chronicling what is happening within their territory. We are saying that it is absolutely unacceptable that people who are simply reporting independently about what is happening within the territory of South Sudan should be handled the way that Justin has been.
Could it be that because Mr. Lynch, in one of his reports recently, talked about the fighting between President Salva Kiir's forces and Riek Machar, presenting a potential for genocide? Could it be because of this kind of reporting that he was expelled?
No, of course, you will know that I'll not be able to know nor speculate why they decided to take this very drastic action, and I wouldn't be able to say that.
What would you like for the South Sudan government to do? Let Mr. Lynch come back into the country or what?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that the South Sudanese government needs to completely allow unhindered access for foreign correspondents into the country. And as we said in the report, this is very necessary now, more than ever. And we would say that they need to appreciate that journalists are not the enemy. It is the situation on the ground.
Muriti Mutiga is the East Africa representative of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. A non-governmental organization, Haki Africa, has accused Kenyan security forces of making dozens of people disappear between 2012 and 2016. As Rael Ombua reports from Nairobi, the group's new report focuses on Kenya's coastal communities where there is a large Muslim population.
A Haki Africa report entitled, What Do We Tell the Families?, details the deaths or disappearances of 81 people over the past 5 years. This includes 22 deaths alleged to be due to excessive force by police, 4 deaths in police custody, 31 cases of alleged extrajudicial execution, and 24 cases believed to be enforced disappearances. Haki Africa Executive Director Hussein Khalid says Kenya's counterterrorism, police, and members of specialized units were involved in the cases, and the victims all have something in common.
Although most victims on our list are youths, there are also sheikhs, imams, and preachers, some of them well over 50 years old. The common thread is that all victims are Muslims. All fall into a category of being perceived by authorities to be actual or potential terror suspects.
Haki Africa interviewed relatives of the victims, witnesses, and government officials. Muna's husband was picked up by the police a year ago.
Naomba serikali iniambie pale walipompeleka. Manake alichukuliwa na polisi.
Muna, who did not use her real name, says she wants the police to tell her where they took her husband. She says her children ask her every day where their father is. She does not know what to say. Coastal communities in Kenya have been increasingly caught between violence meted out by Kenya's security agencies and the threat of violence by extremist groups against those who do not share their views. The report says the extrajudicial killings and disappearances have taken place amid a wider set of iron fist tactics deployed by counterterrorism forces. The result is that many coastal communities perceive themselves as victims of collective punishment, eroding trust between community members and authorities. The report also says authorities have failed to conduct proper investigations into those who disappeared, with no official confirmation of the identity of the perpetrators. The Independent Police Oversight Authority has the powers to investigate the police, but not other security departments. Its chairman, Masharia Njeru, had this to say.
There is no doubt whatsoever that we cannot counter radicalization. We cannot deal with terrorism by breaking the law. That is totally inexcusable. We are a constitutional democracy, and there cannot be any excuse at all for members of the National Police Service, or indeed any other members of the national security organs, not adhering to the rule of law.
Haki Africa's Khalid says he strongly believes the best weapon available to fight the injustices of terrorism is the promotion of human rights, rule of law, and a just society. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
At the end of this month, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will leave office after a decade at the helm of the world body. He sat down with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir to reflect on his time as the world's top diplomat.
He has traveled the world trying to prevent and end conflicts, promote development, and lessen the effects of climate change. Along the way, he has met scores of world leaders, refugees, and victims of natural disasters. Ban says it will be up to historians to judge his legacy, but he points to the ambitious 17-point Sustainable Development Agenda to end poverty as one of his most important accomplishments.
I'm confident that by 2030, the older people will be in a much better way in living in a healthier, more prosperous and more peaceful world. And this is my hope.
Ban also says he is proud of the Paris Climate Accord, which went into effect last month.
It required a lot of political mobilization, and it required forging a stronger partnership and raising the awareness of the government leaders and business leaders and civil societies.
Ban also has been praised for the UN's efforts to end the death penalty, improve women's rights, and fight violence and discrimination against the LGBT community. But his list of unfinished business runs long.
When it comes to continuing crisis in Syria and elsewhere, South of Sudan, Yemen, Central African Republic, and elsewhere. We have to show unity of purpose and the solidarity for the people. Often, I have been shocked by the lack of empathy of some world leaders.
Ban, a native of South Korea, also is preoccupied with the mounting tension on the Korean Peninsula because of North Korea's repeated nuclear and ballistic missile tests. He tried to go to North Korea last year, but Pyongyang canceled the visit at the last minute.
It was a unilateral cancellation. I really tried to do whatever I can to contribute to, first of all, reduction of tensions on the Korean Peninsula and also promote the reconciliation between the two parts of Korea.
There has been much speculation about Ban's future. At 72, he is still full of energy and looks unlikely to change his workaholic ways. He has long been tipped to be a top contender in South Korea's 2017 presidential race. But recently, the country has been engulfed in a political crisis that could see the current president impeached if she doesn't resign, which could move the election forward. Ban says South Korea has resilient and mature democratic institutions, and he is confident it will come through the current crisis. As for a presidential run, he will only say that he is keeping his options open.
When I become a civilian, private citizen, then I will have to discuss this matter with the leaders of Korean society, my friends, my family.
Until then, he will keep everyone guessing. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Life in a poor neighborhood of Bamako, Mali, comes with plenty of hardship, even for the able-bodied. 7-year-old amputee Adiaratu Sanogo faced her own set of additional challenges until a chance roadside encounter launched a life-changing sequence of events. Viewers Azuma Kampori explains in this report narrated by Marcus Harton.
Adiaratu lost her leg when she was hit by a motorcycle. After the accident, she learned to get around on crutches and nurtured a dream to someday ride a bicycle. To help support her family, she begged by the roadside. That's where she caught the attention of Issa Traore, a biomedical engineer who spends his spare time inventing things.
When I saw this little girl on two crutches, I don't know, it was too much.
Motivated by compassion, Traore launched a project, a new leg for Adiaratu. With her family's approval, Traore set to work. He used salvaged parts and materials. 3 weeks later, the new leg was done. He called it Exosapien 1. Total cost? Less than $330.
The fulcrum moves. The joint also flexes. As she grows up, the prosthesis can be adjusted to it.
That was viewers Marcus Harton narrating a report by Azuma Kampari. And that's it for this Thursday, December 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.